So today we change gears and we move to the third part of these lectures, where part one was introduction to ADS-CFT and all the motivation that surrounds Maldacena's duality, coming from large N, from the decoupling argument, from holography, from RG, and so on. So that was part one, was understanding and coming up with motivation and with evidence for the duality. In part two, we started exploring the duality by studying one particular class of observables in gauge theories, which are non-local observables, in particular Wilson loops. And now we move to the third and last part of this lecture, where we will focus on local observables in gauge theories. And maybe at the end, I don't know what I'm going to do in the last, say, two lectures, maybe in the end I will try to put back everything we have seen in a common framework, and I don't know yet what. If you have suggestions, let me know for stuff that you would like to hear about. So today, it will be today what we will do. So before I tell you what we are going to do today, is there any question about these first two parts and about yesterday's tutorial? Are you now more or less confident about computing minimal surfaces in anti de Sitter? And it's fine. Very good. So today, there was a question? No. Yes.
In the advanced part, one of which the supersymmetric Wilson loops the logarithm was 0, 1. So, are always supersymmetric Wilson loops proposed to be 0s?
Those very supersymmetric Wilson loops that you studied, their expectation value is 1, yes.
Okay.
I mean.
Okay. So then the circle is not supersymmetric.
The circle is not, I don't think it's as supersymmetric as those in that sense. In the sense that those, they really manage to have trivial expectation value. There are many other things that we could do concerning non-local operators, as I said, Tuft loops, Wilson loops. Even just with Wilson loops, we consider the expectation value of one Wilson loop. You could consider correlation function of two Wilson loops. You have two contours, and now the gluons can go between the contour or also from contour A to contour B. That would be an expectation value of two Wilson loops. There are many, many observables. And even if an observable has expectation value 1, like the ones Zeter was mentioning, correlation functions of these operators might be quite non-trivial. And they are. OK. So today, what we are going to do, I think that you should tell me if I'm going too slow, because basically I'm only going to do conformal field theory. So many of the things you will have already heard before. So maybe you will want me to speed up a bit. In that case, just let me know. For example, let me just remind you that in a conformal field theory, two-point functions are totally fixed by conformal symmetry. And we can choose a base so that they are orthonormal and just given by 1 over the distance between the two points to the power of a number, which is called the dimension of the operator. Three-point functions, the functional form of them is also totally fixed by symmetry. Once we fix this normalization, there is, however, a constant C1, 2, 3 that is not determined by conformal symmetry. So right now, we have two sets of numbers, the deltas that fix the two-point functions and the C's that fix the three-point functions. And what I want to show you today is that this forms what we call a conformal data. If you know 2 and 3 point functions in a conformal field theory, you can compute higher point functions by gluing the 3 point functions together. Did Jaume cover that part of conformal field theory? A bit? Okay, so we can go a bit fast, but let me then remind you, what about the 4 point function? Well, 4 point function, we can come up with something up to here, don't look at this F yet, that naively obeys everything you need to obey concerning conformal symmetry. It scales properly and so on. But then you can still have some functions of some combinations of variables like these ones, like these two ratios, that are totally invariant under conformal transformation. What's the name for these ratios? Cross ratios, right? So there are, with 4 points, you can construct what you call cross ratios. And the cross ratios are invariant, so any function of these cross ratios, z and z bar, I will choose a parameterization where this is normally what we call u, and this is normally what we call v, but I will parameterize u as z times z bar, and v I will parameterize as 1 minus z times 1 minus z bar. Just a choice of parameterization. Then finding four-point functions amounts to finding this function f of these two cross ratios u and v, or equivalently z and z bar. And the idea, what we will see today, the main thing that we'll see today, actually there are two main things we will see today. One, I will remind you of radial quantization, and the second thing is this conformal data stuff, that we can find the functional form of this function f just from the knowledge of 2 and 3-point functions. Okay. So, and there will be also some nice geometrical meaning for this z and z bar, but maybe we can postpone it and move on to what I want to cover. Okay. So let me just remind you, again, that part I know that you saw, so I can be brief here, about the state operator correspondence. This will be brief, and here I want to make a connection between anomalous dimensions in a conformal field theory and the spectrum of that conformal field theory. Let's see. So suppose we put the field theory on R4. So let this be R4. Okay. So R4 we can parameterize by some radius and then spheres as d minus 1, which is in this case S3, in case of R4, around the origin. So we parameterize in radial coordinates, and the metric is just dr square plus r square times the metric of a three-dimensional sphere. Now you know that you can make a wild transformation, which basically means going to the variables where r is equal to e to the tau. And in this variable, you see that Minkowski is conformally equivalent to a cylinder. Let's see. That R4 is conformally equivalent to a cylinder. So dr becomes, so there is an e to the 2 tau outside. And then you have d tau square plus d omega of S3. So the R square disappears there. Okay? So R4 is conformally equivalent. In a conformal field theory, it means that you can work either on R4 or in any space which is while equivalent to R4. That is equivalent. Once you have an overall factor, you know that you can study the theory on this space-time and know as much as you know here. But what do you know when? What do you do when you do this wild transformation? You end up with tau that runs from minus infinity to plus infinity times S3. So let me represent this like this, where this direction is tau. This line, say here, for example, tau equal to 0 corresponds before to a unit sphere, r equal to 1. Here, tau equal minus infinity corresponds to what was before the origin, r equals 0. And tau equal to plus infinity corresponds to r equal infinity. And remember that this line here, in this picture, it looks like it represents a circle, but that's of course because I'm drawing it in the blackboard. This line represents a three-sphere. Just I don't have enough dimensions. Now, important. The space-time is this plane here, and now it's the boundary of the cylinder. It's not the full cylinder, it's the boundary, right? I mean, you have d tau, which is this, and ds3, which is this circle. The boundary of the cylinder is equivalent to Minkowski. When I say Minkowski, of course I mean R4, Euclidean space. So then we have a map. Here we can put some boundary conditions at the origin. Boundary conditions at the origin. In other words, that's equivalent to putting an operator at the origin. Right? By definition, boundary condition, like you put an operator there at the boundary. But then, that point there is mapped to minus infinity in this cylinder. So that will correspond down here. That will correspond to preparing a state here. Right? So we put some operator there. It corresponds to putting some state over there. So this is just this radial quantization and operator state correspondence that you know, that putting operators here amount to placing states in n equals 4 in a conformal theory, which doesn't live in Euclidean space, but lives in, so this, if this is R4, this is R times S3. But you see that before, what was a dilatation here, is mapped to what here? It's mapped to time translation. In particular, just this trivial observation tells us something that will be very important for the future, but not for the rest of this lecture. And the very important statement is that anomalous dimensions of a conformal field theory in R4 are equal to the set of energies, because those are conjugated to time translations, of the same conformal field theory when put in R times S3. I'm sure Jamet told you this. Am I wrong? Very good. But I wanted you to remind this. We will use it tomorrow. Okay, so for now, this is like an aside. I'm just reminding you. A few days ago, I wrote in the wiki that you should revise this part. I mean, so think about this if this is not totally clear. And the take-home message right now is that there is this correspondence between putting operators and putting states. And in particular, a very pragmatic outcome is that if you have a conformal field theory, you put it in a sphere times time, which means you put it in a box, right? A sphere is some compact space. So you put the theory in a box. There is some spectrum, which are the energy levels of that theory in that box. And that spectrum is equal to the spectrum of anomalous dimensions of the theory in R4. That's the statement. Okay. Let's continue reviewing some other stuff that you also know, just to set the notation. You also know that there is something called the operator product expansion in a conformal field theory. Namely, it's something very simple. If you have two operators and you look at them from very far away, you see that there is something disturbing the origin, which is, say, the midpoint between those two points, but you cannot distinguish that from just a single operator. Right? So it's like a dipole expansion. So let me be more precise. What I want to write is that if I have two operators, suppose, inside some sphere, and I have here two operators at some point x1 and x2, so let this be O1 at x1. Do I want to use x1? No. Let's suppose one of them is at the origin, at 0, and O2 at x. This is equal to, from someone seen from very far away. So again, how can we, okay, let me write the result and you will tell me if that's clear or not. Some constant ci that can depend on x times an operator oi at 0. So you see, I'm just seeing from very far away. I know that there is some disturbance close to the origin, and I can decompose that disturbance in all possible operators put at zero. Okay? This is familiar? Is this clear? So this is this physical picture. You look from very far away. So these two points, I can think of them as being some effective point at the origin that I expand. Okay? Here is another way of thinking about this. These two points, you put them inside the sphere. Okay? Are you following? So now, do the path integral. And you put these two points, and you are doing your path integral over the fields, and you reach the unit sphere. Okay? Now you are at the unit sphere. So it means that you are at this time slice here, tau equals zero. Now take this time slice and do the path integral, and do the path integral to minus infinity. You end up here with some mess, which is a linear combination of all possible states. But what is that? That's the sum of operators. Okay? Clear? So put operators, evolve to the sphere, sphere map here, here, evolve to infinity, get the mess. That mess is a linear, by definition, is a sum of states, which is a sum of operators. Good? More precisely, you know that in a conformal field theory, it's very useful to sum over primaries. There are primaries. Let's call them K. And then we have descendants, which are obtained by just taking derivatives of these primaries. So we can say that these constants, we can write them as CK. CK, not to be confused with CI. Maybe let's put a tilde. There is some CK. Now I'm summing only over primaries. CK of X times OK at 0 plus CK mu of X times derivative with respect to mu of OK of 0. This would be a descendant plus C with two indices, mu 1, mu 2. Of X, derivative mu 1, derivative with respect to mu 2, okay, at 0, plus dot, dot, dot. Okay? Very good. So, the first thing we notice is that this C's, they can, of course, be constrained by conformal symmetry because the left-hand side transforms in a given way. The right-hand side better transform in the same way. Now, under a dilatation, these two points transform and get a weight of lambda to the minus delta, where delta is delta 1 and delta 2. So under a dilatation, OI, so under a dilatation, where x goes to lambda x, OI goes to lambda to the minus delta I times OI. So the left-hand side goes to the left-hand side times lambda to the minus delta 1 minus delta 2. Okay? And by matching this with the right-hand side, you see that, for example, OK transforms with lambda to the minus delta K. So this CK must compensate and transform. So, for example, CK must transform as, or let me do immediately all the C, mu 1 up to mu n, must transform into lambda, let me write. So it must transform in the same way as it must get its weight. So minus delta 1 minus delta 2 to get the left-hand side matching with the right-hand side. It must cancel the transformation of the primary, so plus delta k, that cancels the transformation. And because the derivatives, they also have weight, they also have to cancel the weight of the derivative, so we have to sum plus n times ck. Okay, so we know something about these C's.
Question?
Yes?
Are there a way to think about this decomposition of the operator product expansion in terms of the primary and the descendant, in terms of this path integral that we did for?
Yes, in the sense that the Fock space, the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory, is precisely generated by primaries and then creation operators that create the descendant. So it's the natural way of parametrizing the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory is like that.
Okay.
You have the fundamental fields, which are the primaries. And then you connect with creation operators that get you descendants. Like many harmonic oscillators, if you want.
I mean, like when we go
to minus infinity, in principle, you get everything. You get the primaries and the descendants. Everyone is there. That's why we need a sum.
I mean, like here, there is a like conceptual difference between the primary operator and the descendant.
No, not really. I mean, from this point of view, what's the big conceptual difference? There are some operators, just some primaries, O, D of O, D square of O. I mean, they are all equally good operators. What do you think? Why? What conceptual difference are you seeing?
I mean, we distinguish them.
No, we do, yeah. Because that's the way we organize. For example, what do we mean? No, an important point. The primaries, for example, if you write a primary, this is, of course, for primaries operators. For primaries, correlation functions are constrained. So we better use primaries as our building blocks. For a descendant, what's the correlation function of two primaries and a descendant? Suppose the descendant is like two derivatives of the primary. What is that correlation function? Okay, you go here and take two derivatives with respect to the x3, and you get something. Right? But so for the operators that are primaries, only the primaries transform in this way. And therefore, only for the primaries, the argument of claiming the argument used to derive that form holds. That was important in the derivation. So you see that because of this n here, there's something very intuitive, of course. We know intuitively that terms with more and more derivatives, when you have an operator and then derivatives of the operator, look like a dipole expansion, right? So we know that they should be more and more suppressed. And indeed, we see that because of this n, it means that this c will have to be a polynomial in x's of higher and higher degree. So these c's, they are more and more suppressed as x goes to 0 when we increase, when n increases. Okay? So the dependence on x of this field must be homogeneous in x. It must get this weight, so it means that a function of x must contain x to the power n. But then, of course, as n is bigger and bigger, when you send x to 0, they are becoming more and more irrelevant. So the most important terms are, say, the first three that I wrote here. The one, when you go further and further, they become more and more suppressed in this OP limit. So now, what we are going to do, let's fix the CK. We can fix all of these guys. Okay? So let's do that. Of course, using conformal symmetry. Now, this is very simple. For example, what is... It's very simple. Let me show you. What we can do is, of course, this is an OPE where you take 2 points and obtain a third point. So we can extract these coefficients by taking inner products with the third operator. That's the natural thing to start. So let's start from there. Let's consider the three-point function, O1 at 0, O2 at x, that's what we have there. And then let's consider OK at y. Now what is this? This is equal to C12k, where this is these numbers that appear in the three-point functions, over, and let's just copy what we wrote there, x to the power delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k, you see? If you compare there, x2 is 0. Then x1 minus x3, which is y to the power delta 1 plus delta k minus delta 2. And then there is one, which is x minus y to the power delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k. And of course, this is equal to C12k. Let me factor out the powers of x. Delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k. Let me factor out power of y to the power delta k. Okay. Now, once I factor out this delta y to the power delta k, I want to write the following. I'm confused. Sorry.
You have 2 minus delta k.
Sorry?
You have 2 minus delta k.
Yes, there's something wrong, right?
The last exponent on the first line.
So let's see. This one involves the point x and 0, 1 plus 2 minus k. This is good. This one, y and 0. So it should be 1 plus k minus 2. And this one is x and y. So it should be 2 plus k minus 1. There is a wrong thinking. Minus plus. Very good. So now it's okay. So we factor out y to the power delta k, which is what appears here and here. And then what we end up with is, let me write and you can check, 1 minus 2 x dot y over y square plus x square over y square to the power delta k minus delta 1 minus delta 2 over 2. Okay? So absolute value of x minus y is x minus y square square root. And this is what you get. Is it clear for everyone? I mean, maybe it's not so trivial to do it by head, but it's actually simple. Factor out this guy, then you can divide there by y, and this is what you get. Okay? Very good. Now, let's expand this at small x. So this is equal, or let me maybe, yeah, let's expand just this part. What is this equal? This is equal to 1, let's expand at small x, plus delta k minus delta 1 minus delta 2 over 2, expanding at small x, times y dot x over y square plus dot dot dot. Okay? We are just expanding this. So let's call this 1. Now, on the other hand...
Question?
Yes.
Shouldn't there be a minus then in plus?
It's possible. Let's see. What did I write here? Delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k. And then... There should be a minus, right?
And a factor of 2 probably as well.
Factor of 2 as well. That's good. Thank you. Very good. Thank you, Andrew. So good. On the other hand, we can use this. And then we will compare both and fix the cis. So on the other hand, the correlation function, we can compute it of O1 of 0, O2 of x, OK of y is equal 2. Now we plug the sum here. So we plug the OP expansion. And because you take inner product with k, only the term with k, maybe I should put here k prime, only the one with k equal k prime survives. All other ones, they are orthogonal. Yes? Is it clear? Sum over k, so only k contributes. So there is no sum anymore. So only k contributes by the two-point function orthogonality. And we get just ck of x times correlation function ok of 0 ok at y plus ck mu, okay, plus, what am I doing now? Plus ck mu, okay, yeah, that's right.
Why do you have so many k's? Or is so little k's on the left?
Sorry?
We have 1, 2, k, then k, k, k.
That's right. Because I'm plugging, for a 1 or 2, I plug this expansion. and only the term with k here, think that there is k prime. Should I change this? If you want, I can change. Let me put a j here. Only k equal to j contributes. This is more clear?
Okay.
Just so that I don't need to change dummy indices. Plus c mu, and what do I get? I get correlation function, I get derivative with respect to the correlation function of derivative with respect to mu, oj at 0, oj at y, plus, etc. That is plus c mu 1 up to mu n, j, that depends on x, times correlation function of d mu 1, d mu n, of operator oj at 0 with operator oj at y. Yeah? Is it clear? So then, it's clear. So what is this? This is equal to cj of x times this correlation function, which gives 1 over y to the power 2 delta j.
Denominator, absolute value y to the 2 delta k?
It should be, right?
Yeah,
I did a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Thank you, Satoshi. So indeed, here there was a mistake. There is a 2 miss. Very good. So this one is just a 2-point function. It's just 1 over y to the distance. What about this one? This one gives derivative of the 2-point function. So this one gives just c mu j of x times derivative of the 2-point function that gives 2 delta j y mu over absolute value of y to the 2 delta j plus dot dot dot, and this one gives something. Many derivatives of the 2-point function. Okay? Is it clear? This is just derivative of the 2-point function. Right? So now, let this be 2. Okay? So comparing, can I write here? Do you prefer that I write there, or can I write here? Sorry? Here is fine? So comparing 1 and 2, what do we conclude? We conclude that ck of x is equal to what? Is equal to c 1 to k over x to the delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k. Just comparing this 1 with this guy, I read what ck is. I read that ck mu of x is equal to c 1 to k over this. This factor is always there. What do I get here? Comparing both this term now with this term here. Huh? So can someone tell me what I get to the next term in the expansion? What do I need cj to be so that these two match?
Well, there should be 1 over 2 delta j.
Good. So let's start. So we have to kill this 2 delta j. There is no 2 delta j there. So as Dalimit said, there is 2 delta j here. More.
X mu over y.
Very good. So then there is this y dot x. So y mu x mu. But here we have y mu c mu. So c mu is x mu. Here, and more, and then this stuff here, delta 1 plus delta 2 minus, by the way, I'm using k, minus delta k. Yes? And you see that C, mu1, mu n of x, k, is equal to C, 1, 2, k, over this factor, x to delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k, times something which is totally fixed by conformal symmetry. Just have to expand further. If we expand one order further and compare, we get the next one and so on. Okay? So, again, these guys, it's not such a surprise, but we just showed that these guys are totally fixed by conformal symmetry, and they are all proportional to C1, 2, 3, but the constant of proportionality is totally fixed by conformal symmetry. So the overall scaling of these factors is not fixed. That's the structure constant, C1, 2, k, but then they are totally fixed. So they are totally fixed by conformal symmetry, and of course, they depend, they all just depend on the C, as we said, and on the deltas. On the deltas of the two operators of 102 and on the delta of the primary. Okay?
There is a factor of y squared which I don't see.
Sorry?
In equation one, we have over y squared, which I don't see.
Y squared comes from this y squared here.
No, I don't see how does it cancel when we multiply this with this. We don't get the y squared.
Ah, because I forgot. When you take the derivative, right?
Plus one.
When you take the derivative, there is here plus two. Very good. Sorry. Right? You take the derivative, 1 over y to the 2 delta j. So we take the derivative, you increase the power in the denominator. Very good. Thank you. So you see, everything nicely works, and you fix this cis completely by conformal symmetry. Okay, this is not yet the 4-point function. What we were doing was something a bit more general than the 3-point function, taking the OP of these two guys, and we learned what are the structures appearing in the OP of two guys by knowing that when we put three together, we must get this. So we constrained what can appear in the OP of two operators, and we constrained how the higher OPE coefficients are constrained to the first OPE coefficient. So now the idea is, now that we know what happens when two operators collide, let's pick the 4-point function and send the first two operators one against each other and the last two operators one against each other. But let's do it slowly. Let's first actually send just the first two operators, O1 and O2. So let's consider a 4-point function. O1, by the way. Now let's consider, let's go to the one that we are really interested in learning. O1 at x1, O2 of x2, O3 at x3, and O4 at x4. So this is equal to a sum over the primaries k, and then we apply the OPE for the first ones. We get C1, 2, k. Let's use some notation. Let's denote all these coefficients by C1, 2k. No, I put it down, right? So C1, 2k, right? Times something that is totally fixed by conformal symmetry, right? Some things that we know that we call B, mu1 up to mu n, and that depend on x. Then we get C1, 2k. Then we sum over n, and we get B, mu1 up to mu n, k. Did I put the index k in B? No, I forgot. B mu1 up to mu n of, now of the, they are not at zero, so f of x2 minus x1, right? So this is the origin, this is x, so the distance is x2 minus x1, times derivatives d mu1 d mu n of the correlation function O k at x1 at the origin, which is x1, times O3 at x3, O4 at x4, where by these derivatives, I mean derivatives that act on x1. You agree? Yes or no? Yeah?
So the index of B is 1, 2, and 3, right?
The B, yes, B knows about 1 and 2. Yeah, that's right. So this C here, of course I wrote CK of X, but CK of X knows about 1 and 2. I'm just making the notation a bit lighter. Now, this correlation function is totally fixed by symmetry. So what we get, so now this stuff here, what is this? Okay, let me write the final result. So the final result is the following. We have a sum over k. Okay? C, 1, 2k. And now from the three-point function there, we get C, k, 3, 4. Right? You agree? And then what do we have? Then let's put a bracket. Then that these constructor constants multiply a sum from n equals 0 up to infinity, b mu 1 up to mu n of x2 minus x1. That depends on the operator k, and as Mohammed reminded, also on 1 and 2. But they are totally fixed, and they just depend on the deltas. So these guys are fixed, and they are functions of delta 1, delta 2, and delta k. Okay? Times derivative, let's be more explicit with respect to x1, mu1, derivative with respect to x1, mu n. These are these derivatives. Then the three-point function, what's the three-point function? 1 over, we already wrote this, this is the third time I'm writing this, x, 1 is at k, so okay, it's better to write it because indeed it's easy to do mistakes. 1 is k, so k plus 3 minus delta 4 times, let's see the other one, x1 minus x4 to the power, 1 is delta k, so delta k plus delta 4 minus delta 3, and then 3 and 4. X3 minus X4 to the power delta 3 plus delta 4 minus delta K. And now I close this parenthesis and I close the squared one.
The structure constant.
Sorry?
Constant.
Okay. No, the structure constant, very important. The structure constant, I took it out. Now, all this stuff, all this stuff is totally fixed by conformal symmetry, right? And this is totally fixed. In this bracket, we know as many orders as we know. We just expand further this stuff, we rub the b's. This is a function. This is a totally fixed function that we can call f. Depends on k, it depends on the external operators, and let me denote this to indicate that I fused 1 and 2 and then fused 3 and 4. And this function depends on the positions x1, x2, x3, and x4, and on the deltas of the five operators, the four external and the internal one, but it's a totally fixed function. You agree? So this is just a nice base for expanding four-point functions. And this function here, what's the name of this function? This is what we call a conformal block. So the conclusion is that this four-point function, okay, we can represent it graphically in this nice way. And by this, what do we mean? We mean that there is a sum over all primaries k, c1 to k. We create the primary k. It propagates with some function which is totally fixed, which is the conformal block, that propagates from the group 1, 2 to the group 3, 4. And the 3, 4 ones, we can also think that the primary then splits into the points 3 and 4. So if you know all the deltas in your theory, you know these functions explicitly. If you know all the c's in your theory, you can construct this sum and you get the 4-point function. So the 4-point function is totally fixed by knowing the conformal data of the theory. Okay? And it's actually very simple to see that this has a finite radius of convergence and so on because of this path integral picture.
And this works every dimension if it is conformal.
Very good point. So this is really very powerful. I mean, this works in all possible dimensions. And for different dimensions, of course, taking these derivatives and so on will be slightly different, and we will get different conformal blocks. So these conformal blocks also depend on which dimension we are. So let me see. What do I want to say? Any question here? So the main point of this lecture was to show that the conformal data fixes completely the form of a four-point function, and we just did. If we know these three-point functions, and if we know all the anomalous dimensions, we know this function conformal block, and we just plug them there. Keep in mind, this conformal block is really the analog, say, of plane waves. Plane waves are the good functions that you use to expand when you have translation invariance. And you just decompose a function in plane waves. It's useful if it's useful in problems when you have translation invariance. What are spherical harmonics? They are functions, which are good functions when you have the rotation group. They are functions that carry, that are eigenvalues of the Casimir of the rotation group. So they carry the good, they are the eigenvalues with the good quantum numbers of the conformal group, of the rotation group. So these conformal blocks are nothing but the analog of those partial waves, of those plane waves, or of those partial waves like the spherical harmonics and so on. But generalized to the conformal group, not to the rotations or to the translation. So they are really fundamental functions, like Bessel functions, like spherical harmonics. They should be, and they will probably be implemented soon in Mathematica. And you just write conformal block with argument, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, tag, and you get a function, which in principle we can compute. And now I'm going to write what is the explicit form of this function.
Question.
Yes.
So the OPE, if you consider all the k's and all the descendants, is exact.
Yes. Yeah. The OPE has a finite radius of convergence because of this picture of just doing the path integral, and unless you hit singularities, you have a finite radius of convergence. So what happens is that. Okay. So now that we achieved the main point, and what follows, I want to just present some comments and some further remarks, which will not be crucial for the rest of the lectures. For the rest of the lectures, what the take-home message from this lecture is that it's extremely important to know how to compute 2- and 3-point functions, because in principle they suffice to construct higher point functions. And then in the remaining of the lectures, we will exactly focus on that, computing 2- and 3-point functions. Of course, in practice, you might ask, is this the best way of computing 4-point functions and the simplest way? No, it is not. Most likely, almost no one, or maybe no one, computed for the first time a four-point function using this. But that's not the point. I'm trying to point out a conceptual point of view, that this fixes completely the conformal field theory in not a Lagrangian way, but really an axiomatic way, if you want. So it really defines the theory. It's the definition of the conformal field theory. But it's still a very interesting question to understand how to study four-point functions and higher-point functions per se. But okay, now we are extremely motivated for studying these deltas and DCs. But before we move on, which will be the subject of the next lectures, I want to still have some comments about this OPE stuff. When you have 2 points, x1 and x2, you have this picture that you are seeing it from far away. So basically, again, remember, we have some sphere centered around x1. Okay? And we can think of this exactly. You take point x1, x2, you evolve, you go to some sphere, and then you evolve back and see what exactly you put at the origin. So there is no obstruction for evolving and reducing unless you hit a singularity. Unless you hit another operator. So the radius of convergence of this expansion, if you have an operator, say here, x3, okay, there is a radius of convergence, I suppose this is x3, and let this be x4, there is a radius of convergence of these expansions that is okay, that goes up to here in this expansion. Similarly, for x3 and x4, if I draw some sphere that is centered at x3, I would have some finite radius of convergence of the OPE expansion for these 2 points that would go up to there. So there exists an overlapping region, which means that we can all this procedure is reliable. And that's an important point. I mean, we must make sure that these expansions converge and that it does define the four-point function, and it does. But actually, another point is that not only it converges, but you can actually check the radius of convergence if you don't do x1, x2, and x3, x4, but if you do, say, x2 with x4 and x1 with x3. And you can check that, again, you also have an overlapping region of convergence. So what you can do, we can impose a very powerful constraint on conformal field theories, which is that this picture is equal to this picture. Where you understand what I mean by these pictures, I mean exactly this. So if we expand, so let this be point 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4. So if we expand C1, 2K conformal block C, K, 3, 4, or C1, 3K conformal block C2, CK, 3, 4, we should get the same result. Now, this is a highly non-trivial constraint on three-point functions and on anomalous dimensions of conformal field theories. And this is what is called, this equation, is what was introduced by Polyakov, and it's called the conformal bootstrap. And until 2 or maybe 3 years ago, this was a set of equations that people knew were very powerful, but also very hard to use. And people basically had given up on trying to explore these equations to basically define or understand conformal field theories. But recently, Slava Ryshkov and friends, they have been pushing a very interesting program that I wanted you to be aware of, where by using just these equations, you can derive bounds on dimensions and structure constants in conformal field theories. You can really draw a plane, say, and say, this is the delta, the smallest delta 1, the smallest delta, and this is the delta 2, and you can plot a line, delta 2 of delta 1, such that above that line you have admissible conformal field theories, and below this line you have non-admissible conformal field theories. So just this equation right now, there's a very interesting program in trying to understand this equation, forgetting about just considering any conformal field theory, any dimension, and so on, studying what is the moduli space of conformal field theories. What are the possible sets of deltas and Cs such that this consistency condition can be satisfied for any possible kind of operator? And actually, there will be a conference here at PI in June that I encourage those who are interested in issues of conformal field theory to attend. where we will discuss exactly this kind of things. Finally, let me tell you what these conformal blocks look like. So the conformal block, the four-point function, is the sum of conformal blocks, and the conformal blocks depend on 1, 2, 3, and 4, x1, x2, x3, and x4, right? Now, of course, this four-point function must have some overall scaling, so this function must have an overall dependence on x1, x2, x3, x4 that I can take to be exactly this. So let's call this trivial factor. I don't know, what do you want to call it? Let's call this some trivial factor f of x1, x2, x3, and x4. So let me tell you how these conformal blocks look like. So this f, k, 1, 2, 3, 4, of course they must be equal to f of x1, x2, x3, x4. This only depends on the external deltas, by the way, delta 1, delta 2, delta 3, and delta 4, right? This only cares about the external data. Times a function, let me maybe call it curly G. Okay. That will be a function of Z and Z bar. Okay? Now, if the primary K has dimension delta and spin L, this function G is actually a function G which has an index at delta and del. Okay? And now, it is just a question of computing these B's explicitly and resumming this sum and getting some function. So let me tell you what this function is. It's not such a trivial function, but it's an explicit. It's exactly like Legendre polynomials, if you want. So what is this function, G, that depends on delta and del, and which is a function of these two cross ratios? It's equal to Z, Z bar over Z minus Z bar times, and then there is some quasi-factorization. So there is a function that only depends on Z times a function that only depends on Z bar plus exchange Z with Z bar, where Z and Z bar are those cross ratios there, where this function that we can again just fix by expanding further, where H lambda of Z is Z to the lambda. Okay, so far it's simple. And now the slightly non-trivial part, there is an hypergeometric function F to 1 of lambda plus delta 2 minus delta. Can you read here? Probably not everyone, right? Times an hypergeometric function F to 1 of lambda plus delta 1, delta 2 minus delta 1 over 2 lambda plus delta 3 minus delta 4 over 2, 2 lambda and Z. So you see that these conformal blocks in four dimensions, so this is in four dimensions, like the ones we need in n equals 4, are given by a product of two hypergeometric functions. Okay?
So
this is what they are. So I mean, it's not implemented in Mathematica, but it's simple enough to do it. Just define G to be product of two hypergeometric functions.
For spin, what do you mean with spin? Because you have S2, SU2?
No, the primaries, they can be, when you fuse two scalars, you can get a scalar or you can get any traceless symmetric tensor. And those are the primaries of spin L. It's a traceless symmetric tensor with L indices. Okay? So what we have discussed up here was a bit simplified, where I only considered scalars. If you have spin L primaries, we have to introduce the spin in the above discussion. Sorry, there was a slight jump in what I have done before. Okay?
Yep.
Yes.
So everything that we did today is true in a number of space-time dimensions.
This was for D equals 4. Let me tell you how they look like in D. So now, as you said, what about D equal 2? So in D equal 2, there's something very simple. In D equal 2, you know that the conformal field theory factorizes, really, right, into Z and Z bar. This almost factorizes if it were not for this annoying factor. So all you have to do is, for D equal 2, just remove this factor here. For example.
Okay, but where is the dependence on the number of space and dimensions in the formulas before the video? Because I can't see where there is any dependence. Like in the way how we derive the 4-point correlation function from putting together the points.
That's a good point.
So is it the case that for D equals 2, this is just 1, or?
Sorry?
Is this the case that for D equals 2, this is just 1?
This quantity here?
Yeah.
No, you have to drop it.
Because in two dimensions, U and V are related to each other.
No, that's not true. Let me come back to that point if you want later, but no,
yeah.
That's not true. So, it must be in the spin part, which I did not discuss. Yes, the spin, that's right. So once you consider the eigenvalue, once you consider the spin, then the three-point function between two scalar operators, that's right, two scalar operators and an operator with spin. So this was for scalar operators only. Now suppose the primary O3 is an operator with spin, so it's traceless symmetric. Then it's also fixed by conformal symmetry. But now you have here a tensor structure, and that tensor structure depends on the dimension. So it's for the spin part. So again, it's an important point, which somehow I don't want you to be misled. So in all this discussion, I ignored that the fact that the primaries that can be exchanged don't need to be scalars, and they could be operators with spin. But now, once I wrote this, I put back the spin as if I had done it already with spin. So you can think that there is a jump. I showed how it works, what's the idea without spin. With spin, it's exactly the same. The only difference is that if that operator OK has spin, this is not just 1 over this, but some tensor structure that is also fixed by conformal symmetry. So you would have just here some tensor that you would have to take derivatives of. OK? But there was a jump. So be aware of that. The treatment was done for scalars, and then now I'm presenting the result already putting also the operators with spin, just giving you already the full result. But you see that conceptually there's really nothing different.
But for example, if you have scalars,
yes,
in the OPE, can you have some combination of spin operators?
No, if you have scalars, when you contract two scalars, you can show that the only representations that can appear are symmetric traceless. So they are just parameterized by the number of indices, which is what we call spin. I suspect that Chomet probably told you this, no? That in the OP of two scalars, you get symmetric traceless representation of the conformal group. He did not? Okay, anyway, this is a true statement. But again, so yeah, for scalars, you only have operators with spin. L and delta parameterize completely the primary that flows. And what we have discussed, if you want, is only the case L equals 0. And now I'm already putting the case where you have some delta. Okay, so this is D equals 4. This is what happens for D equals 2. Can you make a guess for D equals 3?
Square root.
Sorry?
The square root of it.
That's a nice guess, yeah? But it's not correct.
Logarithm
of it. No?
Some function, correct?
It's not known. you see, such basic question, like knowing what's the analog of plane waves. Imagine this was the situation. You knew plane waves in two and in four dimensions, and you did not know in three. And this is the status. That's one more reason why we are having this conference in June. There has been very recent progress. It's not yet published, but we will hear about it in June, about finally understanding these conformal blocks in three dimensions, which is extremely important, of course. It's a missing piece in our knowledge of conformal field theory. So no one knows. People know recursion relations, differential equations. Dolan and Osborne, which are the people who invented these conformal blocks and who played most with it, know a lot about them. But there's nothing as explicit as you have for four and two dimensions for three dimensions. You can have it. You can try maybe to see what you find.
In which theory the people working and in different theory?
Sorry?
Which theory?
No, this is totally theory independent. It is just kinematics, right? I mean, this is just conformal symmetry. It's like just saying that if I have spherical symmetry, I use spherical harmonics. It's totally independent of the theory, right? It's just kinematics. Here it's exactly the same. So we don't know the analog of spherical harmonics for three dimensions conformal field theory. That's the status. We know some representation of this guy, like with four nested suns and so on, but okay. There's nothing reasonable known yet. So people tried square root, it doesn't work. So it's not that simple. Don't go home trying square root, you will lose your time. So now let me just make one comment, because Andrew was pointing out that in two dimensions, maybe the cross ratios.
They are related. In two dimensions.
Maybe they will be related, so let me just explain why they are not. So, so.
In two dimensions, v is equal to 1 minus u.
No. So, no, it's not true. It's not true. So, the first statement is the following. You have a four-point function, so you have four points x1, x2, x3, x4. Now, by conformal transformations, what can we do? So, when you have 2 points, you can put them wherever you want. When you have 3 points, you can put them also wherever you want, 0, 1, infinity. What can you do when you have 4 points? What can you do when you have 4 points? You can put one at 0, one at 1, one at infinity, and the other one, it's 3. Right? So you have 0, 1, infinity, they draw a line, and the third one. So there is a plane that goes through the 4 points. Right? So a generic configuration can always be mapped to a plane. So there's no difference between two and higher dimensions. So your statement is not true.
So in Vince.
So let me do it slowly. Now, what you might know is that.
But Ginsberg says otherwise.
You should show me, because let me show you that it cannot be true. And actually, you know that in two dimensions. Okay. Let's see. So if you have general points, x1. X2, X3, X4. Let me remind you how it works. For example, first, you can make a translation so that X1 is at the origin. Okay, so this is after the translation. Then let's do an inversion. The inversion sends this point X1 to infinity. So after translation and inversion, we have X2, X3, X4, and X1 is equal to infinity. Okay, let me see this. No, I want to send x4 to infinity. x4, x1, so x4 now is at infinity. So what have I done? x2, 3, 4, 1. This is after an inversion and a translation. Then I can do another translation. So this is a translation and then an inversion. Then I can do another translation so that, say, this point, so which point do I want to put at the origin? So that x1 is at the origin. You agree? Yes, Andrew, you agree?
Yes.
Now, make a rotation so that you rotate so that this x3 is in the x-axis. So you make a rotation centered at this point to rotate that point to the x-axis. So now you have x1, x3 is somewhere here, x4 at infinity, and x2 somewhere here. Now make a rescaling so that this point is at 1, 0, and this point is at 0, 0, and this is at infinity, right? Now this point is somewhere here. Now make a rotation along this axis so that this point is in the plane. Okay? Now let's parameterize this point that is now in the plane. So this is what we end up. So I just showed explicitly how just by conformal transformations you end up with this. Of course you knew that you could put points at 0, 1, infinity, but maybe you did not see before how to do it in this very explicit way. So now let's parameterize, let's call this coordinate of these points x and y and define z to be x plus iy and z bar to be x minus iy. Okay? Then what is zz bar? Zz bar is the distance between x1 and x2. So zz bar is the distance between 1 and 2 squared. And 1 minus z times 1 minus z bar is the distance between 2 and 3 squared. And indeed, this is a nice geometrical way of understanding what this cross ratio z and z bar is. Let's see. Suppose we send x4 to infinity. So this ratio is irrelevant. X1 minus x3 is 1 because 1 is at 1, 1 is at 0. So the distance between 1 and 2 is zz bar. Okay? What about here? We send x4 to infinity, so this and this cancel. X1 minus x3 is 1. X2 minus x3 is the distance between 2 and 3, and it's indeed this. So you see, I mean, if you have 3 points in the plane, to parameterize the position of the other point, you need 2 coordinates. Now, what you can say is that in the two-dimensional conformal field theory, if you know the function of z, then you know the other function is the same function of z bar, right? So the dependence on z and z bar are automatically constrained. Once you know the dependence on one, you know the dependence on the other. But that's not to say that you only have, with one cross ratio, you parameterize the position of 4 points in the plane. You don't, you see, you need 2. Does it agree now with Ginzburg?
So Ginzburg has everything in terms of z's.
Right, but that's exactly what I just said. So that in a conformal field theory, it factorizes. Mm-hmm. So you can work indeed only with z's. But you agree that then the final result for what's the correlation function of 4 points will be a function of this position. Okay? Unless I'm missing something basic, which is possible, but let's discuss it otherwise if you think it's so. Okay, is it clear? So this C and Z bar, they're just cross ratios. They have this interpretation if you fix 3 points as being the as being the coordinates of the fourth point. And the main message from today, there are 2 important messages to keep in mind. One is that these deltas and C's, as we see, they are extremely important. They form a conformal data that fits completely the conformal field theory. And the other point to keep in mind, and I urge you to think about them if they are not totally clear, the other important point to keep in mind is that the dimensions in a conformal field theory are equal to the energies of the conformal field theory in R times S3. Okay? So of this lecture, these are the 2 facts that we are going to use. So that's it. Questions?
Does it change a lot with supersymmetry?
Sorry?
Does everything with it?
Well, what happens with supersymmetry? Of course, this still goes through, of course. But you can ask, can I do better now? Because now I don't have just a conformal group, I have the super conformal. So now there are primaries that are related by supersymmetry. So can I put them together in something that I could call a super conformal block that propagates the primary and everyone related by supersymmetry? Those objects started being considered a few years ago by people like Interligator and others that will be here in June. More. No? Let me raise this in case. Okay, for tomorrow, please revise the tutorial on the geometry of antidesiter. Really, it's important, the first tutorial.